That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Broadcasting from Resistance Headquarters, relentlessly fighting back against the clown dictator and his regime of deplorables.
Never give up, never surrender.
This is the Bob Zeska Show, presented by BubbleGenius.com.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, June 19, 2019, and this is the interview edition of the Bob Zeska Show. My guest today is someone whose name you might not know, but whose work you definitely know. I first met Jim Biederman when he was hired by VH1 to be the showrunner on my animated sketch show Illustrated back in 2003, and we've been friends ever since. More notably, Jim was also the executive producer on such shows as Kids in the Hall, The Howard Stern Show on CBS, The Tom Green Show, The Andy Dick Show, I'm with Busey, The Onion News Network, and so much more. He's currently working on the History Fluffer podcast with Dave Hill, link in the description. So get ready for some TV talk today, and if you like what you hear, please consider supporting this show by subscribing to our bonus content at BobSeskaShow.com. And now, let's talk with the great Jim Biederman.
Hello.
Jim Biederman, it's Bob Seska. How are you, man?
I'm good. How are you?
Great, great. You know what? It just occurred to me just as I was dialing your phone number. You know, this might be the first time we've ever talked on the phone when I haven't been freaking out about something. That's kind of amazing after so many years. So History Fluffer, how did you end up being corralled into doing a podcast?
Dave Hill and I had done a pilot for TBS called You Had to Be There. Mm-hmm. And the concept, backing up a bit, about a year and a half ago, I consulted for 10 Cent, which is the Chinese Netflix. Mm-hmm. And Shanghai Media Group, which is the kind of the Comcast of China.
Yeah.
And I went to Shanghai. and I consulted on their sketch comedy shows and their comedy roast battles, which was a trip and a half.
I can only imagine. What was that like? I mean, what are those shows like?
Well, the interesting thing was that the sketch show. Someone told me that in China, a guy who grew up in America but now lives and works there, told me that in China, on television, sketch shows, the first sketch show on Chinese television was 1985.
I'm sure it was hilarious.
Which is, I'm sure it was. So what you're immediately faced with is the kind of the realization that, say, Anglo-American, so British-American comedy has about 150 years maturity level or maturation on Chinese comedy.
Yeah.
But the Chinese, based on their alphabet, which has 4,500 characters or something crazy like that,
yeah.
They're totally into puns and wordplay. And so there's a lot of who's on first kind of stuff. There's a lot of that, because the same word pronounced slightly differently, literally spelled the same, but pronounced differently. You know, you could be calling your mom beautiful or a fat cow, you know, and that gets a huge laugh. And so, but that was fine. So the sketch show was very much like they put their pants on the same way we do. And, you know, there's the grumpy lighting director. And I mean, it's the crew's the same. The cast was very, from what I could tell, I don't speak Mandarin, but they made me laugh just watching them.
Yeah.
But the weird one was the roast battle, because they do not have a tradition at all. Well, the closest tradition they have, of course, is kind of Mao's self-critique, you know, that would be the closest thing they have to a roast battle. So, you know, so they go overboard, like, yeah. And then they're told there's a government censor everywhere,
yeah.
And they're told, no, you can't say that. You can't say that. So then you're reduced to literally your, you know, your mama jokes and puns, but about a day or two before the taping, I have to tell you, the whole thing was so surreal, and I had a translator with me, and there was a minder for me, and on the weekends I was free to do whatever I wanted, except, you know, they'd say, well, we have a minivan waiting for you. I said, no, I'll go for a walk. And Shanghai's an amazing city. And I would walk, and I literally feel like I was being followed, and sure enough, I was being followed. But it was strange. But anyway, so about a day and a half before the taping, live audience, like 400 people in the audience, the television center comes to us and says, we've decided that the last act should be a joy act.
Yeah.
And everyone in the room goes, okay.
What is a joy act?
As in happiness, joy.
Yeah. Okay, I see. So a happy ending for the sketch show.
Right, exactly. Okay. But this is the roast battle.
Oh, the roast
and
battle.
So
right.
Everyone kind of nods accordingly, and they, oh yeah, sure, no problem. And I'm told later that what that means is that after, I think it was 9 acts. This is a weird. It was like hour 15 or hour 20 show. So 9 acts. After 8 acts, the 9th act would be after 8 acts of basically saying, you know, Bob, you know, your mother's so blank, whatever. They then had to tell each other how much they loved each other.
That's amazing. Yeah. So in China, that's an important element of broadcasting to make sure you get some love end.
No, it's all about propaganda, and it's all about fascistic government control. Mm. But that, you know, we're all Chinese and we all love each other, you know, except for the ones we're imprisoning. But I think it was fascinating because if that didn't blow your mind enough, what blew my mind beyond that was at the taping, not a dry eye in the house. Tears from the audience, from the performers, saying, hey, man, I know I told you your mom smells funny about an hour and a half ago, but you know what the truth is? I'm just so happy to be working with you on the stage.
Yeah, you're never going to see that with, like, Jeffrey Ross or someone. They're never going to do that.
I was going back to China. I went to Beijing. Yeah. Netflix, they don't have Netflix. They don't have HBO. They have Tencent, which actually is a big co-owner, I think, of Spotify.
Yeah.
And they're fascinating. I mean, but everything is you know, you don't ever really forget you're trying to do comedy in a dictatorship. And so there's a lot of misdirections, and there's a lot of, well, we'll just say it's not, you know, we'll do sketch on the government, like going to get your driver's license, but we won't say it's your driver's license. Like, they're always trying to stay one step ahead of the government. And they're all the millennial generation, which is the biggest generation in China at this point. They're fully aware of the horrible irony that they exist under in terms of trying to do comedy.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you go out drinking with them and karaoke, which they love, and they get smashed, and they tell you, you know, they'll tell you how horrible it is. And then, like, a fucking light switch goes off, and they'll say, but I'll tell you, it's better than, I'm glad I live here as opposed to in the United States. And I'll say, why? And they'll say, because your government doesn't care about you. And our government is like having the most loving mother and father ever. Now,
wow.
Yeah, but you know what's funny? As I thought about it, I thought, wow, that's true black, you know, brainwashing. But then I thought about the part about the United States. They weren't wrong about us. our government doesn't really care about us.
No, definitely not. Right. Unless you're a Trump supporter. And then you honestly believe that Trump loves you more than he loves himself.
Right. Exactly.
Sure.
So it was fascinating. The whole thing was fascinating. I had gone back and forth over a course of 9 months. And,
yeah.
Anyway, but what I started to really I became obsessed with this idea of what is that kernel like. So I could go and, you know, I would have the sketches or jokes translated for me, and I'd have to kind of, the translations are terrible, so I'd have to kind of, oh, I get it. You know, I have to really figure it out. But what's that kernel, that one thing that we all find fun, like, no matter what your language, no matter what is that? And it can't just be slipping on a banana peel.
Yeah.
And also this whole idea that that, you know, in the United States, certainly in arguably most Western developed countries, comedy isn't a dangerous act.
No.
But there are, in other countries, even in India, which is an inferior democracy, there you can get killed for telling the wrong joke.
That's right.
And in China, you can just get disappeared. And, you know, I became fascinated with this idea that for us, it's, we take it for granted.
Yeah.
And the rest of the world, I mean, there's comedians, there's a Nigerian Daily Show. It's not The Daily Show, but it's their version of a ripoff of The Daily Show that sometimes just doesn't go on the air for weeks on end because the government decides they can't, or they've kidnapped the host, or they've killed one of the producers. And I mean, but these people still get up every fucking morning to tell a joke.
Yeah,
and so I started to think, like, really became obsessed about it. So Dave Hill and I, who I've known for a long time, and I said, listen, I'd like to take you and kind of to soften the edge, basically, but basically kind of do an Anthony Bourdain about comedy around the world. And we sold it to TBS and we did a pilot. And then they came back and said, this is great, but it's kind of too similar to what Conan sort of does, and the travel part.
Yeah.
So we were figuring out how to work together. And one of the things that Dave does really well is he just tells these bullshit stories. So History Fluffer came out of the idea that what if Dave was that guy at the end of the bar who, you know, if you and I are talking about this, he'll, you know, perk up and say, I was in China once, and then tells the most incredible bullshit story.
Yeah.
And so that is History Fluffer. And I'm a big history fan, so it's great to basically fuck with history. So that's what it is. That's the long-winded version of it.
But wow. And you know what? I'm hearing you talk about China and you actually trying to work in comedy in China. And I'm going, you know, that's kind of a common denominator in your career, Jim, is working with insane people in insane situations. That's like, I could list just right off the top of my head, like at least half a dozen shows in which you're at the center of this amazing tempest of creativity and madness all around you. And usually it's centered on one other guy.
I don't believe in reincarnation per se, but I have to believe that I've killed more than one person in a previous life. And so now I'm,
Right. I haven't been on a TV pitch in years and years and years, and so much has changed over the last 10 or 15 years. And I'm not saying that from an old guy point of view. I was like, oh, I remember back in the old days when TV was TV. What I'm saying is it literally has changed even in the past couple of years. I mean, what's it like? I mean, how has the industry specifically changed for someone in your role, as someone who runs these shows and goes on these pitches, what are you up against now that maybe you didn't go up against, or you didn't have to go up against, say in 2003 and 2004 when we were last working together?
It's the same thing, although it's the one element that's heightened, makes it incredibly difficult to sell, is fear.
Yeah.
So you have executives who, as you know, were always fearful. They're just fearful of losing their jobs. They've always been that way.
Yeah.
But now they're fearful that they're, you know, forget about getting fired. They may walk in tomorrow and their job just may not exist.
Yeah.
And it is the disruption that is going on in the industry in terms of where the power is.
Yeah.
Makes it extremely difficult to sell. And what's also happened is, as the movie business has become less and less of a actual business, and by that I mean volume business, the downward pressure on us, you know, low life television scum, has been that now the actors who, the A-list actors, writers, and directors who can't get their movies made, go, oh wait, I can do the 6-episode version of my movie and get as much, the same amount of money, if not more. And so you're now competing against Brad Pitt. You know, you're going in at 2 o'clock, you're going in at 2 o'clock, and at 2:45, Brad Pitt's coming in. I wonder which one they're going to buy. So it's very, very difficult. And I think a lot of it is basically this weird idea that still prevails that if I do have Brad Pitt, people will watch, and it doesn't translate. And then, of course, the whole social media aspect of it is another weird thing where you have older, middle-aged executives buying a show from someone who's an influencer.
Yeah.
The worst phrase in the world.
Thank you. I so agree with you.
It's burned down the house. But, you know, Instagram or Twitter or Facebook or wherever they are, and ideally they're racist, but they have 2 or 3 million followers.
Yeah.
And they'll say, wow, they have 2 million followers on Instagram. We'll do a show with him or her. And here's the part that, you know, the Nimrod executives don't understand. The act of engaging in social media is what Marshall McLuhan would call, you know, a hot medium. Mm. Whereas watching television is a cool medium in the sense that when they do brain scans of people who are watching television, literally their entire brain goes blue because it's the ultimate drug.
Yeah.
And you're just, there's no activity going on. You are passively accepting whatever is being sent to you.
Exactly.
If you're doing social media, if you're engaged in social, if you know, you're the one driving your narrative. So you click on a link, you don't like the link, you click on another, you're going down the rabbit hole yourself. You're directing that.
Yep.
And so what they've done when they do brain scans of that person's head brain is red and yellow.
Wow.
And so why would I like, and whatever dopamine that releases, why would I watch someone on television because I follow them on Instagram? But network executives think that there's an equality there in terms of, mm-hmm. And so then they're surprised when the 2 million viewers don't show up for their shitty cable show with their shitty influencer.
Right.
And it's only like 50,000 people. And they go, wait, but what about the Instagram? Mm-hmm. And you just want to shake them and say, it doesn't work that way. It's just, do you wonder why your audience are leaving? They're leaving because you are not providing the same kind of literally dopamine that they get from doing it themselves.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? I feel like, and I don't want to put the cart ahead of the horse here and get into when you and I first started working together. But I mean, with my show, which is an animated sketch show, I always thought that we were kind of up against that challenge, the red versus blue brain challenge,
right.
There, the passive
right.
versus active right. challenge, where the my stuff kind of worked well in that active sense online, but then you transfer
right.
that into a longer form TV format, and then suddenly things start to break down. And I'm not sure if that's the same dynamic, but certainly that was a point of consideration, given that I was coming from the internet and trying to adapt that to TV. So I may have been one of the first ones to kind of try to make that leap from influencer to television. Yep. And yep. So we were kind of both up against that to a certain respect at that point.
There's no question. I think, and to extend it just a little bit, the metaphor a bit, and that is what, if not that, we were up against another thing, which is the translatability, which I think is what you're talking about, which is when I would see your clips online, I would get a thrill. I mean, it would be thrilling, almost not only discovery, but also there was an intimacy between me and your website.
Yeah.
You know, there was a connection when you're then, piecing, you know, 2, 3, 4 minute sketches, animated sketches together for a 30, 22 minute show. You know, there's a translation problem, but also I would argue in terms of where we were, which is even further extending the metaphor, the wrong audience.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the VH1 audience, they're trying to transfer something from,
right.
you know, like a 18 right. to 25 demographic online to,
right.
you know, 35 plus women on basic cable. And that was a
right.
hell of a leap. But you know what? The fascinating thing that I saw, Jim, after it's kind of after we finished doing the sort of abbreviated 1.5 seasons that we did, is that a lot of those sketches got pulled out, added to YouTube, and they now have like the SpongeBob cartoons that we did for the VH1 show, that the VH1 that Steve Hillenburg didn't let us do, that Nickelodeon wouldn't let us do.
Right. I remember.
Yeah.
I remember.
Those somehow leaked onto the internet, and they now have, there are millions of versions of it. Each one has millions and millions of views. I'm kind of sounding like Trump here, but it's true. They're downloaded all the time on YouTube, all over YouTube. There are German translations. I mean, there are insane things happening with that series of cartoons. And again, perfect example. We couldn't even get that one on the air on VH1.
Right.
And it was huge on YouTube once that finally came around.
Right.
Perfect example.
Again, it's exactly what the issue. And so you now have executives who, if you haven't noticed already, I have no great affection for, that who are truly hogs. I mean, whether they're dumb or not, I don't know, but they're, you know, I'm sure they're all very nice people, but they're just cogs in the, you know, in the machine, and they're running scared, and they don't ever think about why social media attracts a certain level of audience and why their stuff doesn't. And that's the hardest thing. I mean, because at the end of the day, yes, you're still pitching a good idea. You're still pitching a talent that's involved that they want to be in business with or not. You're still pitching something they haven't heard, or it's a version of what they haven't heard. So all of those things remain, but that one element, which is the part where in the weirdest way, they feel that they have the time is on their side by not making a decision.
Yeah.
When I would argue, how? Forget it.
Yeah, right.
Don't even talk about time. The sand has literally, there is no more hourglass left. And so I think they don't think that way. They're Hollywood. I think you and I had this conversation 15 years ago.
Sure.
Hollywood is a reactionary industry for an industry that is arguably built on technology and always has been. I mean, the camera, the projector, everything, all the way up to now. It's an industry that only exists because of invention and technology, coupled with you print money, and then finally coupled with kind of ego. Notice art has nothing to do in those three pillars, and that's what drives the industry. But for an industry that is basically the foundation is innovation and technology. I've never met a bigger bunch of technophobes and morons when it comes to technology than, by the way, any studio, network, cable network, production company, development company. Just spit out a window, and whoever you hit, they will not know how shit works. And it's amazing to me.
Yeah. In fact, you and I got stuck with at least one executive along the way at VH1 who not only didn't understand the technology, he didn't understand cartoons or sketch comedy.
No.
And we're doing technology, we're doing cartoons, and we're doing sketch comedy. Right. He didn't get any of that. I mean, I'll never forget having a conversation with that guy where he's giving me a note on one of the sketches. He says, well, Bob, I guess Tommy Lee was in one sketch, and then we brought him back in a separate sketch a couple of sketches later in the show. And he's like, well, Bob, how does Tommy Lee get from Los Angeles to New York in just a few minutes? I'm like, what are you talking about? It's a sketch. It's self-contained. And then it's the same format in which Bugs Bunny blew into his thumb to reinflate his head. And that's the universe we're dealing in. It doesn't matter whether Tommy Lee could physically get on an airplane and travel to New York City in 3 minutes. It just happens. These are the kind of conversations that we were having with those guys at that network. And I shouldn't say guys, it was one guy.
I, by the way, still have those conversations.
Yeah.
And I've now gotten to the point where I just stop and go, I'm sorry, do you care? I mean, really, I mean, at the end of the day. And there's this usually a long pause and they go, yeah, you're right, never mind. And they move on. But I mean, the problem, I think, is that well-meaning people like you and I feel we need to answer the idiot in the back row's question.
Right.
when they go, well, how does he get across country? I mean, he was just in New York. And you just say, well, I mean, and it's a, I, either being raised well, or it's just, you know, just don't want to be rude. But I really, as the older I got, I just, it's okay to be rude.
Yeah.
It's okay to just say, I'm sorry. Do you give a fuck about that? Cause I don't. And by the way, if you're giving a fuck about it, then we've failed.
Right. Well, see, that's one of the things. I mean, that must be a new development for you, Jim, because one of the many things that made me want to be you when I grew up was you always made your work seem effortless despite all the madness around you, whether it was coming from the talent that you were working with or the executives that you're working with, or in many cases, both. How do you deal with the stress of the idiot executives, the difficult talent, the deadlines, network pressure? I mean, do you feed off of that excitement, or have you just developed a way to holster your emotions in those cases?
I think it's a combination of both. I think there is, and I will say that when I'm not on a show, I'm not a depressed person per se, but I get depressed. I get like kind of antsy and anxious. And then yet, by the way, at the same, for the same, in the same token, when I'm in a show and I'm dealing with, you know, name any of the crazy people I've worked with, it's like all I, in my head, it's just like, I just want to have a week off and just not have to talk to them. But I know that in that week off, I'll be crazy by Tuesday night.
See, now, the other thing is, too, is I always thought that you would be a great network executive yourself, and I'm sure you've had offers, but the problem is you're too smart and too centered to be a network executive, I think, and it sounds like you're really into the sort of the pulse-pounding nature of being in the thick of the production. Is that right?
I see. It's an interesting thing. I mean, I've certainly, there's offers have not that many, but I've certainly entertained them. But I think if I'm being honest with myself in taking those jobs, I would be so jealous. Like if you were producing a show for me and I'm the network, I would be so jealous of you that you got to be creating something, no matter how painful that creation was for you. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I might even be causing some of that pain as the network exec. I would still be jealous of you.
Yeah.
And so I think, I'm not one of these people, like, I don't believe in the romantic artists, you know, struggling, pained, or, you know, artist, that the only way art comes out of is through pain. I don't believe in any of that shit. But I will tell you, it's fun. It's so much fun to be in the middle of me, you know, it's fun to be creating. Mm-hmm. It's just fun. And no matter how difficult or time consuming, or in some cases, you know, it can ruin relationships that you have. It's still its own drug.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I would never want to be the person who's just giving you notes, because I would be very, very jealous.
I'm sure. I've never asked you this, Jim, and we've had many, many conversations, a lot of time spent together. Yeah. And I don't think I've ever asked you how you first became interested in working in television. I mean, did you always see yourself as sort of the man behind the curtain, sort of the wizard behind the scenes, or did you have performance aspirations or what?
No, I never really had performance. I mean, in high school and shit like that, but nothing. It never drove me.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I've been doing more and more of it lately. Not, and more is, you know, a strong word, but and I will tell you, maybe up to about 5 years ago, I had nothing but fear in terms of performing. Now I just literally, I could be 1,000, could be 1,500, 2,000, 5,000 people on a stage. It wouldn't even bother me. But, you know, 10 years ago, if there were 500 people, I'd be like, oh, blah, blah, blah. So that's one thing. But I without getting too much into my childhood, became obsessed with Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And I knew every movie that was made from probably 1938 to about 1975. And I could tell you what the studio was. It was almost autistic, but I'm not autistic. Right. But I would just memorize these things, and I would memorize certain, like, B and C and D level actors that nobody remembered, but who had, like, you know, they did 30 movies in 15 years. And, you know, they had, they did well and they were considered stars of their time that nobody remembers now. And my father would do this thing, like he'd have a dinner party and he'd call me downstairs and say, like, name a year and then ask about a star. And Jim will tell you what the movies they were in that year. And I could do that. And wow. it was an escape. It was an escape from a otherwise unhappy childhood. And so and that's all, and I'll leave it at that. But, wow. I think that I became obsessed by it. And so my whole gear was film. I wanted to be a filmmaker. So I got into NYU Film and back in the time when it on the one hand meant even more than it does today, because you were only about 10 or 15 years away from when Scorsese was there. Right.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, probably much more bullshit than it is now. Like now it's actually, it kind of means something. Then it was art school essentially.
Sure.
And so I went to NYU Film and I graduated and I refused to move to LA. I stayed in New York and there's no real film work in New York. What you realize is that even Martin Scorsese has to fucking battle to get his movies made. And so I worked for a Japanese video company. That was interesting. I worked for a small production company in New York that did documentaries. And then I heard about a job at a company called Broadway Video, which is Lorne Michaels' production company. And I jumped at it and I was there for 9 years. So,
and what year was that? When did you start at Broadway?
Was that 90, I think.
Wow.
And one of my first big, and Lorne took a shine to me and he's a difficult person to get you to take a shine. But, and by the way, you don't want the shine at the same time, because the moth can fly too close to the flame in his case. And so,
I see,
you know, he's a very difficult person. So, yeah.
And I'm sure you've got more than your fair share of Lorne Michaels stories, right? Like
I have to back up. The only television thing that kind of, I mean, you know, apart from what everyone else watched. So Carol Burnett, I loved, you know, but then I also loved the $6 Million Man. So, you know, I obviously had no taste, but I remember staying up late one Saturday asking my father, I'm thinking like 10 or 11, and asked my father to, if I could stay up, because there was a band that was going to be on Midnight Special, which was Wolfman Jack.
Oh, yeah.
Wolfman Jack from American Graffiti, and obviously from radio fame, hosted a thing called Midnight Special on Saturday on NBC's on NBC on Saturday nights. And I remember there was a band I wanted to see and I wasn't allowed to stay up that late. It was 11:30. And my dad said, sure, just this once. And he sat with me and this other thing came and said, Wolfman Jack's Midnight Special will not be seen tonight, so that NBC can bring you to the, and this thing came on. And I remember having this, the only other time I had a similar experience was when I heard the Sex Pistols album for the Virgin. And this is, I'm in Denver, Colorado, so that should give you an idea of how mind blowing a Sex Pistols album could be. But it was the same thing where I just was watching this show and going, I don't know what the fuck this is, but I love it.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you why I love it, but it was so different and so remarkable. And so it just had this life to it. And that was the first episode of Saturday Night Live. And I never missed an episode after that. So by the time I ended up working for Lorne, he was obviously a god to me. And the moral of this story is never meet your gods.
Yeah.
And I'd written a memo about something and I worked for the guy who ran the company, not him. And he somehow got the copy of the memo. And he said, I want to meet this kid. And I went and had dinner with him. And I was like literally pissing and shitting my pants. Cause it's like, he's just you and him.
Yeah.
What do you ask him? What do you ask him? And what I realized is that you don't ever ask Lorne anything. He tells you cryptic, weird shit. And I remember leaving that dinner thinking, walking home in down the streets of New York going, what an asshole. Like, I mean, it was just,
Yeah, that's kind of the reaction. Doesn't most people who meet Lauren for the first time are walking away going, what the fuck was that all about?
Yeah. Yeah. No, he would say, he says these cryptic things that, mm-hmm. you know, it's a little Chauncey Gardner-esque, you know, it's kind of, you know, well, you know, Jim, the garden needs to be watered. And you're like, oh yeah. And you think it's really deep. And then you're like, no, it's true. Gardens need water. Like he didn't say anything mind blowing. And so you realize that, you know, he's a charming man. He's an intelligent man. He obviously, you know, he has a vision. I don't know what it is, but he definitely had one at one point. He's complicated. He's crazy.
He's kind of an iconoclast, right? I mean, there's no one quite like Lorne Michaels, right? There's mm-hmm. no one. It's like Larry King or even William Shatner or Donald Trump, for that matter. They're kind of on their own track, separate from the rest of society.
Correct. Yeah. And I think that it's funny that, you know, he was out in L.A. and he was obviously from Toronto, but he was in L.A. before he, you know, doing Lily Tomlin stuff and mm-hmm. Flip Wilson shows and things, and Laugh-In. He was on Laugh-In as a writer. And he, when they sent him to New York, it wasn't his idea to do the show from New York. It was the guy, the head of NBC, who was like, why don't we do like old time, old schooly thing and do it live from our old shitty, you know, Studio 8H. Mm-hmm. And he's told, so I've had, subsequent to that dinner, I had way too many dinners and travels and whatever with Mr. Michaels. But the most interesting thing, that the times when he's regaling you with stuff where you aren't bored is, or at least I wasn't, is when he would tell you, because by the way, there's only so many different ways you can hear how he met Chevy Chase, because it's the same fucking story over and over and over again. And I've seen, the only person I've ever seen kind of put him in his place regarding that was Don Ohlmeyer, who used to run NBC, unpleasant man in his own right. But I remember sitting in a meeting with Lauren and a bunch of people, Warren Littlefield and Don Ohlmeyer, and Lauren starts in with his usual, when I first met Chevy Chase, and then you know, everyone starts to go to sleep because they've already heard the story 500 times. Don Ohlmeyer went, yeah, 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 blah, blah, blah. And it's just so, it's so through Lauren. I've never seen him actually thrown. It was like, he didn't know what to say.
Oh my God.
But anyway, the one time, the stuff he would tell me about that I just couldn't get enough of because I'm a geek, is he would tell me how when they got to Studio 8H, they didn't even have cameras. They had to go find the old cameras from, you know, crosstown in storage. And, and they were using like 1965 cameras because NBC just never up, you know, was, you didn't upgrade in the back then. That was it. You know, maybe you went to color. That was it. Mm-hmm. And they had to do all this work on the studio. And it just was really, really cool because on top of the fact that they basically made a show that changed the face of comedy, I would say, internationally, they were also trying to figure out how the fuck they were going to film it. Like, they didn't even have cameras. And so it was like, I'm always impressed by, you know, it wasn't just Sisyphus and one rock. It was Sisyphus and like 10 boulders, you know, and mm-hmm. he did it.
Yeah.
He did it.
Yeah. It's so really amazing that was able to be pulled off. And then how long were you at Broadway Video before you got assigned to, or I don't know what happened. How did you end up at Kids in the Hall?
So I worked for a guy named Jeff Ross, not the comedian, but he actually the producer of Conan. Mm-hmm. And when Conan took over Letterman's slot, this was 92, something like that, 93.
Yeah.
Jeff had been the EP on Kids for about a year or two. Mm-hmm. And I had, and Jeff would send me up to do stuff. Like when he didn't want to go up to Toronto, he'd say, let me just go for the weekend. I'm like, okay. And I'm an assistant basically. And, but Lauren really liked me and he's like, he took me out to dinner and he said, "What, Jim, what do you want to do?" I said, "I want to be a comedy producer." He said, "Okay, great. Trial by fire. You're going to start on Kids in the Hall on Monday and you're the EP."
Oh my God. Wow. And, like, and it was that fast.
And then it was, you know, then he started talking about, you know, when Paul McCartney, blah, 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 blah. So, I was like, I remember waking up in a literally cold sweat on Monday morning, like in the morning, like 2 in the morning, thinking like, I can't do this. I don't know anything. I know nothing.
Yeah, and you hadn't met the guys yet.
I had met like one or two of them, but the rest of them, no, and particularly Bruce McCullough, no, who was the most difficult of them, yeah. But in a good way. Mm. But I went up and I was like, just kind of bullshitting my way through that week. Yeah. And I remember it towards the end of the week, we would tape on, I think it was Friday or Saturday nights. I can't remember, but they would do filming during the week and then roll it in front of the audience. And Bruce came up to me on Thursday and said, by the way, I'm not going to be here on Saturday. I'm going on vacation. I was like, we're taping. And he said, yeah, I know. I'm going to Big Sur. I'm going to go surfing and blah, blah, blah. And I said, I'm 30, maybe 31. Yeah. And I said, you can't do that. And he said, oh, okay. All right. Well, fuck you. I'm going. And he turns around and walks away. And as he's walking away, I said, I literally not thinking about it. I said, Bruce, you're fired. Cause that's what bosses do, I guess.
Right. And, and you were serious. I mean, you're just like, okay, I'm going to fire one of the kids in the hall.
I'll fire him. Yeah. Yeah. And he stops dead in his tracks. His back is to maybe like 10, 15 feet away from me. His back is towards me. He slowly turns around and stares at me for, it just felt like forever. And I'm just thinking, oh fuck. And he goes, just starts breaking up in laughter. He goes, I like you. that was it.
Did he not go on vacation on Saturday or what?
No. And by the way, he was never going on vacation. That's the whole thing about Bruce. Ah, that it was
a test.
Let me fuck with you.
Yeah, see, I was just going to say, as soon as I found out it was a test, that's when I would have fired him. It's like, oh, damn you, bastard.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I got along with them great. I got along with all of them great. I mean, I think Mark McKinney said once that Jim was the only one who could talk to all of us. Yeah. Like he could relate to all of us. And they are a five-headed monster. I mean, Scott Thompson, it's a different conversation that you have with Scott than you do with Mark, and certainly a different conversation that you have with Dave than you do with Kevin. And and yet, if you attack one, forget it. You're battling Medusa. And I think it's interesting because Barnaby Thompson, who was an English guy who produced their movie Brain Candy, came up to Toronto, and I was essentially tossing the baton to him to be like, he would do the movie, I would do the TV stuff. And he said, how should I talk to them? And it's like, don't go on and on about how all the movies you've done in England and don't go. And he was a very posh English guy. And he of course went in and started talking about how those movies, and I could just see their eyes lighting up. Like, I would imagine sharks who smell the blood in the water look like right before they go, oh fuck, there's blood in the water. So one of them raises their hands. I think it was Bruce. And Bruce says, Barnaby, where'd you go to school? And Barnaby proudly says, Cambridge. And and they all kind of nod quietly. And then he goes back to talking whatever he's talking about. And then one of them interrupts him again and says, so how many times did you get fucked in the ass at Cambridge?
Oh my God. What is this?
And he goes, his face turns bright red. And he says, I beg your pardon. And they said, how many times did you get raped at Cambridge? And I'm just like burying my head in my hand. And he said, I was never raped at Cambridge. You're losing when you have to say, I was never raped at Cambridge. And
God, the number of times I've been asked that question during a job interview. I wish I had a dime for every time someone asked me that question. Damn it.
Well, then they all just piled on. And it's like, what were you wearing? Maybe you asked for it. Like, it was unbelievable. And it was really the kids at their best, which was their ability to play with each other and to play with others. Like, unfortunately, in that case, a cat with a dead mouse. But I think, I just remember I told you not to do that. It's like, so I really understood them, and I was so honored to work on the show. I was a huge fan of the show.
Yeah.
So did that for 3 years, and then it basically got canceled after 5 years. And came back and I did a few other things for Lauren's specials and things like that. But I really started to, the thing that I was like, I got to get out of here was I had sold a pilot to Fox, and it was a big, big thing. And it was a, like a puppet. It was a life-size puppet show called Wake Up America. And it was a guy, Dennis Klein, who wrote it. And Dennis Klein was on the co-creators of the Larry Sanders Show.
Yeah.
So it was a super dark, fucked up pilot with like spitting image kind of puppets. at the Today Show, behind the scenes of the Today Show. So it's like Tom Brokaw, or a Tom Brokaw kind of character was like fucking an intern right before they went on air backstage. It was like nuts. It was super dark.
Yeah.
And Fox, I remember we pitched it and Fox bought it in the room and I was like, holy shit. And it was like $2 million, super expensive pilot. And I went back to my hotel. This is in Los Angeles. I went back to my hotel and I called up Lauren and I was so proud. Mm-hmm. And I said, Lauren, I've got great news. We sold Wake Up America to Fox. Mm-hmm. They went, great. So you use my name to sell stuff. Is that how this works, Jim?
What?
Well, normally I would have a bit of a Laurenologist. I knew what not, basically. But I was so excited, I didn't say what I should have said, which was, you know, some other version of that, making sure that he couldn't say that. And I said, and then and this is the part I said that just fucked it up. I said, no. We never mentioned your name, as if that's a good thing.
And that's going to help.
Yeah. And he goes, great. So you're telling me you don't need my help?
Jesus Christ, what a mind screw that was. I mean, did he always deal in that? Like, where you stood?
Always. And that's why, and I think if you ask any of the performers, even the ones who will not say an unkind word about him, that's how he wins. He just, particularly for performer, which are even more sensitive to mind fucking, that's what he does. That's what he does. And I remember getting off the phone and going, God damn it. Like, fuck. I'm not going to let that fucking old man ruined my, you know, rain on my parade. So I got on a plane the next day. I went back to New York and I literally on the plane came to the conclusion, like, I have to get out of there. I just got to get out.
Yeah.
Because if I don't, I'll just be like all the other people who've been around since 1975 who really shouldn't have their jobs. And, but you know, and he would always say weird things like, Jimmy, you're safe inside here. I mean, I can't vouch for you outside of Broadway Video, but, like, why? Am I crazy? Like, what? Wait a minute. The way he would say it, you'd start to think, like, maybe, wait a minute. Am I eating my own feces in front of people? Is that what's happening?
Good
and
God.
I don't know it?
Yeah, I mean.
You know, what do you mean? What do you mean you can't vouch for me outside of these doors? Like, why?
Wow, yeah, thanks for nothing. My God. And so at that point, you decided maybe it's time to take a break from Broadway Video and move on. Was that was that next step the Howard Stern show on CBS? Was that the big move? Or was there something else in between that and the Stern show?
So I got offered a job to run Howard Stern's radio show for CBS.
Yeah.
Late night he was doing. And frankly, I mean, I could tell in my meeting with Stern that it was going to be temporary. I mean, he didn't want to do the show. He was just, what we all found out later, and I don't even think Gary Delabate knew at the time, was that he was in the process of getting a divorce.
So Stern was getting divorced from Alison Stern at the same time you were getting hired to run his CBS show.
It was the beginnings of their conversation about the fact that he was unhappy and he wanted to separate. And I think about a year after that, they got divorced. So yeah, it was all around that time. Right. And so he was very cagey and miserable and didn't want to do stuff. And it was difficult because basically all he wanted to do was the E! Show he'd been doing up to that point, which was just robotic cameras filming his radio show.
Yeah.
And then he would take stuff that then we'd put stuff on CBS that even E! Would be like, ooh, I don't know, man, that's pretty hard. And we put it on and CBS would let us put it on. But then every Monday I'd walk into the office and be like a bunch of messages from TV stations across the country saying, yeah, we are no longer carrying your show because we got so many letters and everything.
Yeah.
So I did that for about 9 months. And then there was a weird time in New York where there was just the work dried up. NBC and ABC, I think in the same week, fired 300 people each. So it was like they were kind of contracting back towards Los Angeles.
Yeah.
So we moved to Los Angeles, and I, in so doing, moved the Tom Green Show, which was had just started on MTV.
Yeah.
And Tom wanted to move to L.A., so we moved the show to L.A., and that was a lot of fun.
So you went right from Stern to the Tom Green Show.
Yeah, I think it was like a 4 months. Yeah.
As far as difficulty, that was kind of a lateral move, right? It's like going from Stern to Tom Green.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Howard's much more Machiavellian in his, you know, when he wants to screw with you. Mm. Tom's just manic depressive, and you know, I have to say, it's the first time I mean, learning how to navigate Lorne and to a certain degree Howard was kind of brain building, if you will.
Yeah.
But navigating Tom was a whole other matter, because it was actually navigating mental illness. And I'd never had to deal with that. And so quickly learned was he loved McDonald's, and then subsequently the reason he loved it so much is because it would give him a sugar rush, and then he wouldn't feel, you know, depressed for at least 20 minutes. And so I'd walk into, like, someone would say, you know, Tom wants to see you. He's feeling down. And I'd walk into his office. You know, this is sunny California, but it was a pitch black, like all the blinds were closed and the shades were closed. And he would just be lying on the floor, kind of, you know, arm in arm with gloom. And I would just say, what's going on? And then he'd sit down and, you know, he'd say, well, I can't do the show. I just can't do the show. Like, why not? I just want to be clear here. On the schedule today, it says you're supposed to go out and put dog shit on a microphone and put it in people's faces.
I don't know why someone would be apprehensive about doing that.
Yeah. So how can I help you?
So,
and be like, I don't feel I'm funny. I don't feel that. And I make fun of Tom, but I have to say his genius, Tom's genius, and it is genius.
Yeah.
Is that coming from Canada, the ultimate in terms of polite culture.
Yeah.
You know, taking it's, they almost take British culture one step too far. Mm. And that is just kind of you just don't tell anyone to their face how much you fucking hate them. And so, but what he did was this really interesting kind of physical comedy where he would invade people's space. And so the dog poop on a microphone, or my favorite was when we put microphones inside of dildos, huge dildos, and putting them in people's mouths and asking them questions. And so,
I mean, are you sitting around like watching as these props get assembled, as you're like, okay, how do we get the dog shit to stick to the microphone? How do we get the microphone into the dildo? And go, you know what?
Yeah.
I went to NYU. I went to Martin Scorsese's alma mater, and I can name every movie between 1938 and 1970. And now I'm putting dog shit on microphones. Are you going, how did I end up here?
But that's the perfect example we were talking before. I would really get into, you know, like how it is.
Yeah.
It's a problem you had to solve, basically, you know? And so that's part of the high that you get. Mm. It's like we had this one thing where it was right around the time when people, you know, smoking was on its end, you know, in its final days.
Oh, yeah.
And so, Tom came up with this idea that he would go into a restaurant where there was no smoking, but we would have him encased in this plastic box, like this gigantic plastic box, which would have its own table and chair inside of it. And he would just chain smoke, and it would just be filled, literally, you know, there would not only be smoke in it, but it would just be the inside of the plastic would be that horrific tar kind of dripping down. Like, it was like, how do we make this as gross as possible? And then he would, like, you know, talk through a speaker and order his food, and like a slot would come in, or what, you know, they put the food through a slot. And it's a great bit.
Yeah.
But, you know, trying to figure out how you do that,
mm-hmm.
and how do we get him out of the van and into the restaurant without being stopped. There was
it's amazing.
Called, Pizza Undercutters, which is just brilliant, where we followed a pizza delivery guy, and Tom had a tackle box with like pepperoni and mushrooms, and, you know, and then we had a bunch of cheese pies in the back of a truck. And he would just follow this other guy, this pizza delivery guy, who was a real pizza delivery guy. And just where he parked to deliver, Tom would run out of his truck and like literally get in front of him and ring the doorbell before he did. And say, what was the pizza you ordered? And the guy's like, pepperoni. And he'd like throw pepperoni. And the delivery guy would start getting really angry because he, after the third time he realizes something's up. And by the way, why are these cameras following him? And, the best part of it was when he went to this guy's house and the guy like said, I didn't order from you. I ordered from that guy. He's like, and Tom says, yeah, but I'll take $5 off mine. I'm undercut, you know? And the guy who's like the biggest white trash kind of guy says to him, this isn't run a business, kid. It's not how you run a business. And Tom says, what do you mean? He goes, you should advertise like everybody else. And
you mean the brilliance in that
moment.
You mean Tom was doing it wrong? That's crazy.
Exactly. And the fact that that was, to me, that was the essence of Tom's comedy, is that he would get, you know, a belligerent, aggressive people to basically, like, how fast could he get to blow their top? And, and it was a performance. It was a performance art almost. And so I really, and then we did the Monica Lewinsky episode, which was and a half. And then
that was crazy. I mean, you're on this insane stunt / prank show with Tom. Then suddenly everything takes this super serious turn with, you know, a cancer diagnosis. I mean, talk about the way that was handled, I thought was so great, because it really could have gone horribly awry with that, you know, the cancer episode and Monica Lewinsky and all the rest of it, where it was such a drastic changeover, such a switch from what people knew Tom Green to be doing in the nature of the show. How did you pull that off? It was an amazing feat.
So I remember getting called into Tom's office one morning and he said, I have a question for you. Have you ever had a venereal disease? And I said, no. He said, I said, why? He goes, because I think, and by the way, he's dating Drew Barrymore at the time, not married, but dating. He said, I think I might have got something from Drew, you know. But then you kind of like, well, of course you did. And so I just said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, one of my testicles is the size of an apple.
An apple? Holy shit.
An apple. And I said, what are you talking about? And he said, it's just inflamed and blah, 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 and it's painful. And I said, go to it. Did you go to a doctor? He's like, no. I was like, well, that is not like any venereal disease I've ever heard of. And said, you got to talk to a doctor. And he was like, I don't know. And somebody called his manager, who managed Dr. Drew Pinsky at the same time.
Yeah.
And he called Pinsky, and Pinsky thankfully was like, he's got testicular cancer. He has to go to UCLA medical school right away. Yeah. My professor there, this is his field. I will have the guy clear the decks and get him in today. Mm-hmm. And so Tom went and then called me a couple days later, and he had taken off from work, and he called me a couple days later and he said, so I have cancer. And I said, okay. We kind of already had all assumed something like that. Yeah. And he said, bad. And what we found out later in the surgery is that he had, as he was going into surgery, that the doctor told him he literally had 50-50 chance of surviving. And so,
wow. I didn't know it was that serious.
Oh, it was
crazy.
Really serious. Yeah. Because it had gone on, they were concerned and it might have metastasized into other parts, I don't know, but they were very concerned about that happening.
Yeah.
Because if that had happened, then that would have been the end. Right. And so he said, I said, okay. He said, but I can't do this, can't go through this unless I'm working.
Yeah.
And I immediately understood what he meant. And I said, of course. And he said, so I want to film everything. And I said, okay. I said, here's the deal. We film everything.
Yeah.
And he said, yep. And he agreed. He let us film everything. The only thing he didn't want us to film, which is kind of funny, was the surgery itself. But what we found out later is that the reason he didn't want them is he didn't want the doctors to get nervous because they thought they were being filmed, which was just a weird kind of performer's idea of what doctors do. Mm-hmm. And, but what they film all surgeries, I guess for insurance purposes. And so we got the footage, from, which is like literally an eye in the sky kind of, you know, hidden security camera from above, and they shoot mm-hmm. everything back then. And we incorporated it. It's the only part of the special that he won't watch to this day.
Yeah, there's something weird about seeing inside of you. Like, I had an ultrasound, like a stomach ultrasound, maybe a year ago. And I refused to look right. at the screen because I don't want to see what's inside of me. It's too much mortality all at once, right? Maybe that was his reasoning, too.
It's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
It's exactly what he's like. I don't want to. I'm, for all intents and purposes, I'm dead on that table while they're doing this.
Yeah.
And, you know, when they do internal, when they do that kind of internal, surgery where they take everything out. It is so medieval. I mean, they literally, they scoop your organs out and they kind of plop them to the side of your body. I mean, it's just, it's not, you know,
It's not pretty. It's not
the future.
Yeah. It's not
the future.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
and so it's hard to watch. We kind of sped it up really fast. But that special was interesting. It was, it was hard to do, but I have to say I'm really proud of it.
Yeah, I mean, you should be. It was a monumental thing, not only because of, again, taking that left-hand turn into a serious topic out of something that was entirely unserious, but also the fact that I think Tom was one of the first celebrities to bring testicular cancer to the forefront, to be public about it, because it wasn't.
No, and
it was before. It was before Lance Armstrong.
No, years and years. But I think. What's really interesting, and I didn't know this, is that testicular cancer pretty much hits people from men from like 18 to 35. And after 35, if you're not going to get it.
Yeah.
And one of the things they think, and this is all what we learned through time, is that, a lot of it is trauma based.
A lot of it is what? What did you say?
Trauma based, meaning
trauma. Yeah.
You know, get kicked in the nuts too many times, there's a good chance you're going to get cancer.
Wow.
And so, because basically what happens is, cartilage builds up and then then the cells go crazy, you know? And, and Tom had certainly landed on his nuts many times, skateboarding or doing.
And I remember, you know, he used to do a lot of bits where he was just like yelling at the top of his lungs. I remember one called Rickshaw, where he's going around on a rickshaw with I don't know whether those parliament guard hats on, those big furry hats. Yep. And he's just screaming into a microphone or into a bullhorn right in front of people's faces and just his face turning like 9 levels of purple at the same time. The amount of bearing down and pressure, that alone, to me, would cause lots of trauma
that
too,
probably
right?
Probably caused it too.
Yeah.
That caused it too.
So was Gary Busey your most difficult gig? Was that the most challenging from a talent point of view?
Yeah, no question.
I mean, he literally turned Sam Cedar, who's now, you know, doing basically what I do. I mean, he was the director on that show, and Gary literally turned Sam's hair white from stress. Is that true?
Yep, that is absolutely true.
Amazing.
So Sam, I've known Sam for a long time.
Yeah,
and he directed a movie called Who's the Caboose, which was a faux documentary, a mockumentary about pilot season, which he then went on to do again as a series. But and I don't know how I came up with the idea of inviting him to direct it, but he accepted the job. And then I think he quickly hated me for it. But he started to go gray. I mean, a lot of people on that staff were just Gary. I mean, he's so crazy. I think that show kind of reignited his, at least the interest in him. I mean, he was kind of, you know, very much a cult figure at that point. But then that show really got this idea that, you can play with him. Like, he'll go for it.
Right. Let's say what you're saying is like you could set him up with a premise and he'll play along with that premise, right?
Yeah. I mean, on the one hand, I always thought he was just a fucking nut job. Like, you know, he would tell you, Jim, a quarter of my brain is still somewhere on the Dallas highway. Like, really? They didn't clean it up?
If you haven't seen I'm with Busey, you got to find the clips on YouTube and watch I'm with Busey. It was basically this guy was the main guy was Adam, right?
Adam De La Pena.
Adam De La Pena. And it was basically him just going around and doing stuff with Gary Busey. And that's all you really need. It's a premise for a show.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you how. So the funny thing is that Fred Armisen and I were going to do a sketch show for Comedy Central. Wow. And this is right before he got SNL.
Yeah.
And it was going to be, he did this, which I think he went on to do on the show on SNL, the Latin percussionist character.
Yeah, right.
And kind of a Tito Puente, but not Tito Puente. And and he had done some stuff for HBO where it was kind of hidden camera and stuff. And Comedy Central wanted to do a bunch of his characters. So it was this belabored development process. And I think we were on draft 12 of the pilot script.
Mm-hmm.
And Fred called me up and said, "Jim, I'm calling. I'm in New York." I was like, "When did you? I just saw you yesterday." He goes, "I flew out last night. It was last minute. I just auditioned for SNL. I think I got it." And so, wow. In fact, he did. He had gotten it. So Comedy Central felt horrible, even though it was their own fault. And they said, "Listen, we have this other show. It's with Gary Busey." I was like, "Gary Busey? Like, what are you?" They said, "It's interesting." And I knew Adam from years before. And it was like, "Oh, I know Adam." And so Adam and I drove out to Gary's house in, he claims it's Malibu, but it's actually Pacific Palisades, but yeah. Whatever. And we go in and it is, I mean, you know, cigar smoke lingering in the air.
Yeah.
Piles and piles of VHS tapes, all of them Law and Order.
That's so odd and that would be his favorite. That's the show.
That, well, he loved Law. It was on all the time. He loved it. And he said, he goes, "I got every Biederman. I got every episode of Law and Order here. I got every single one recorded." And I said, you know, there's that weird point where you're like talking to someone who's insane, but you don't really know they're insane yet. And so you have a rational, like, and I say rationally, like, "Oh, you should get a TiVo." And he goes, "Oh, what?" I said, you should get a TiVo. It's a DVR. It's like a VHS, but it's digital. And you don't need all these tapes. And he goes,
"Yeah,
but I got all these tapes."
Why bother with TiVo, Jim? He's got the tapes.
Well, and it was this weird kind of conversation, again, kind of circular conversation. I was like, "Yeah, I know, but then you wouldn't need the tapes." And he always came back to, "But I have the tapes." Like, as if, like, again, what the brilliance of Gary was, or his insanity, was that he actually started to make you think you were nuts. Like,
yeah.
You're like, "Well, yeah, he does have the tapes. I mean, why am I fighting this?" And so, that was the first time I met him, and we left. And Adam doesn't drive, or he didn't at the time. Grew up in California, never drove. And so, so I'm driving him back to his apartment, and I go, "Well, what do you think?" He goes, "Yeah, that dude scares the shit out of me." I was like, "Well, this is your idea. I mean, you came up with the show."
Right.
He goes, "Yeah, well, let's do the pilot." So we do the pilot. It's painful, but it's funny.
Yeah.
And the first episode, he says, "I want to do a whole thing." And Gary really thought he didn't think he was doing a comedy show.
Yeah.
I was doing like preaching and kind of teaching people things.
He's not in on the joke, right?
Well, see, there's a funny thing, because this is a very short sidetrack story, but we did an episode on technology. So every episode was kind of themed. We did it on technology. And of course, you can imagine Gary Busey highly suspicious of technology because, you know, deep state, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And so we went into a Best Buy and we just have, you know, ambushed a Best Buy, and he was going to go in and tell the Best Buy guy, like, all the hidden cameras and all the ways that, you know, corporate America is spying on you, which, by the way, turned out to be true.
Sure.
But back then was like, you know, what a crazy loon. And I remember going, and so he did, in fact, have a quarter of his brain somewhere on the Dallas highway.
Yeah.
And so he learned scripts like mnemonic, you know,
by rote. Is that what you know,
Bible stands for instructions before leaving Earth.
Oh yeah, like mnemonic devices. Yeah.
So mnemonic.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's how he would learn scripts that way, and it's the way he had. It's, you know, when you quarter your brain is removed, so you could only really talk to him about the scene you're about to do maybe 5 or 10 minutes before, and he would remember.
Yeah.
But so I was going down the list saying you're going to go into this Best Buy and blah 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 blah, and he goes right okay. And I said, you know, just go crazy on him. He goes right crazy. And I'm staring at him as he's saying crazy like 20 times, and I'm thinking, this is going to be great. And so he walks away, and he turns just before he goes inside. He goes, "Biederman." I was like, "Yeah." And I walk up and go, "What's up?" He goes, "So just to be clear, I'm completely crazy in this scene. I was like, yeah. He goes, all right. And he goes in, and he is completely crazy in the scene. Like, it's manic. It's insane. It's fucking hilarious. This poor guy doesn't know what hit him. And he comes out. Gary comes out, and, you know, it's Sam yells cut, and we're done. And he comes out of the Best Buy, and he's looking for me. He takes his sunglasses off, and, you know, our eyes meet. And he points to me, and then gives me a thumbs up and kind of like, you know, like I did it. And he walks out, and I'm thinking, wait a minute. Is he not crazy? Like, is he crazy or is he not crazy? Like, I don't know. And it would always moments of like that where I'd be like, wait a minute. He's crazy. I know he's crazy, but now he's actually aware of the, it's like, you know,
yeah,
it's like Skynet or something, you know, it's, yeah. He's become self-aware. So it's like really, really bizarre. It was so weird dealing with him. So the first episode of the series after the pilot, we go up to, the Red Rocks in Arizona and, Sedona. And he's ahead of, he's just like, you know, a hog in heaven and he's just like so excited to be in Sedona because he believes all this, you know, the vortexes and all this stuff. He believes all this new age stuff.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. And so he had hired this woman named Peggy.
Oh yes. I was just going to ask you about the stolen video camera story, which is
to this day,
I repeat that story to anyone who will listen. This is my favorite Busey story that you tell. Okay. So now that I've set that up, no pressure.
All right. So no, none at all. Okay. So Peggy was an aging, a sad aging Playboy bunny. She might have been a Playboy model like in 1968 or something.
Sure.
And, you know, the years had not been kind. And so, but she was his assistant and makeup artist and I don't know, blowjobs. I couldn't tell what their relationship was, but you know, she was like, Gary doesn't think it's funny if he does this. Like, I'm Peggy, no offense. I'm not talking to you about ideas. I'm just not going to talk to you about ideas. And so she'd go back and say, you know, Jim says he's not going to talk to me about ideas. And then Gary would have a blow a gasket. And then I have to sit there in a meeting with Peggy and she'd tell me her ideas creatively. And it's like, the anger would just, I was so angry at the whole time. Cause I was like, this is just fucked. It's just, I just feel like, hey, just be crazy and we'll be fine. Don't analyze anything. So we're up in Sedona and Peggy has a video camera, like one of those really early camcorders. And she announces that it's been stolen. That on one of our shoots, it's been now missing, taken out of her pack. And I go, okay, well, you know, I'll tell you what, I mean, look, we'll look everywhere, but if you can't find it, we'll just put it in insurance and we'll get you a new one. But I really like that one. It's like, okay, we'll get you the same one. No, that's the one. It's got stuff on the video that I really want. I was like, well, I don't know what to tell you, Peggy. It's been stolen. I don't think anyone on our crew stole it, but, you know, look, we'll look for it. So we go back to the hotel, and Gary's calling me all the time saying, you know, someone on the crew, obviously, and I think we should probably one at a time just talk to him. Because don't forget, he's had every episode of Law and Order at home. And he's like, and I was like, Gary, I'm sorry. You're insulting my crew. Yeah. I can vouch for every single member on this crew. No one stole the shitty fucking camcorder that the Playboy bunny brought. It's I'm telling you. And he's like, well, someone did. And so I'm bringing up a psychic from Phoenix.
A psychic now is added to the mix.
Yeah. It's a psychic. I'm going to bring a psychic up from Phoenix and she's going to help us. She's the best. She's going to find out who took the camera. I was like, great. By the way, he had her invoice the production, by the way.
Yeah.
So, I go out with some of the crew. We go and have dinner and I come back and in the lobby of the hotel is Gary Busey, Peggy, an older woman with a cane, she's blind, and a young woman with that older one. And he sees me and excitedly jumps up and says, I should also backtrack one before I get there. And that is that Gary really does believe in Bigfoot and all these things. And he claims to have seen Bigfoot and he's claimed to have seen, you know, alien greys, you know, aliens who live among us. And, he believes all that stuff. So he was telling me that, you know, Bigfoot, a lot of people think Bigfoot, only lives in like, you know, Saskatchewan or the kind of North Pacific Northwest, but actually Bigfoot, you know, he knows of Bigfoot Bigfoot sightings that have happened down by Sedona, which, okay, whatever. And so I come back and he sees me and he jumps up excitedly and he runs over to me in the lobby and he says, "Peterman, do you see that woman over there with the cane?" I was like, "Yeah." She goes, "She's blind." I was like, "No, I can tell." He goes, "She's a psychic." And I said, "Oh, that's kind of ironic, don't you think?" And he goes, Why? I said, "What?" And he goes, Why is it ironic? I was like, "Well, because she can't see, but she can see, you know?" And he was like, "Yeah." And it literally, he does all these things. I guess, again, you're crazy, not me. And so, at this point, I've had it with him. I was just like, he goes, "Well, she told me who took the camera." I was like, "Oh, who took the camera?" And he goes, "Well, she can't see a face." I was like, "Okay. But she saw hands take the camera out of Peggy's bag." She takes the camera. I was like, "Okay. That makes sense. Someone must have reached in and taken the camera."
Yeah.
So I understand the hands part. And he goes, she said something really interesting, though. I said, "What's that?" He goes, "She said whoever took the camera is elusive and doesn't want to be caught."
Wasn't it hiding?
No, I was just going to say,
wasn't there also a vision of it being in a dark place?
Yes, it was in a dark place. The camera was now in a dark place. And I'm thinking, I'm just like standing there going, "Mm-hmm, mm-hmm." And he goes, "So I think we know who stole the camera." I was like, "Who?" He goes, "Well, whoever it is, they don't want to be caught, but she's seeing it. I think we're close." I'm thinking, "Oh my God, you're so fucking nuts." And I said, "You know," and we had had the conversation about Bigfoot earlier that day. I said, "Maybe, you know, I have an idea." And he goes, "What's that?" I said, "Maybe Bigfoot took the camera." And he kind of cocks his head and he stares at me and like in disbelief and says, "God damn it, Peterman, Bigfoot would never take the camera."
That is genius on so many levels, and he obviously doesn't know that it's just a genius response, because as if there was any chance whatsoever of Bigfoot actually stealing the cameras, it's like, well, that's really preposterous.
He got so, again, that weird thing of like, you're the nut job, and he got so angry at me, he kind of stormed off and sat down with the psychic, and I was actually, this whole conversation took place in front of a Comedy Central exec who... Margie Yespa, and she was just sitting there crying, trying not to laugh. Like, it was just, because it was always these insane, and I remember we walked away, she goes, "I don't know how you do it." I was just like, at a certain point, it's just fun. I mean, I told him things like, when he would really act out, and he acted out terribly, I would tell him that I had a secret code, Comedy Central would give me a secret code, so all I had to do is dial in this number, this phone number they gave me, and punch in this code, and I could cancel the show. I could have the show canceled.
Yeah.
And that, and Comedy Central would give me this in case Gary had gotten too out of hand. And he believed it. And so when he would get really crazy and do some weird shit on set, I would say, "Gary, I'm afraid I'm going to have to call the number." And he'd be like, don't call the number, Peterman. Like, he'd get on his knees and beg me, like, "For the love of God, don't call the number. Please don't call the number." I'd say, "Well, I got to call him. It's, you know, it's part of my job." And he would believe this.
Yeah.
And so it was like kind of dealing with like a 5-year-old in a 6'3", you know, battered, you know, 65-year-old body.
Yeah.
And
I mean, now, and now he's president of the United States. Might as well be. That show could have been I'm with Trump. I mean, because they're basically carved from the same iconoclastic mold, right?
They very much so. Someone complained he grabbed girls' asses all the time on set, and it just was like, you know, it was like, come on, dude. And so Comedy Central had a problem, I think, in their New York office. So every production had to read the statement from their business affairs, their lawyers, and to everyone on set. So I got the crew together, read this thing, and, you know, here's what you can't do, here's what you can't, you know, blah, 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 blah. The early sexual harassment lectures, basically.
Yeah, sure.
And I go in and I read this thing to Gary, because I'm by the rules of my employ, I am to read this to everyone. So I read to Gary, and it's like a paragraph. At the end, I go, "So," and I'm supposed to ask this question, "Do you understand everything I've just said to you?"
Yeah.
And he looks at me and goes, "No, I do not." And I said, what part? And I'm like thrown by it. I was like, oh, really? I can go over. Which part do you not get it? He goes, the whole fucking thing. And I was like, well, why not? He goes, because men and women are meant to be together. And I was just like, oh my God. I was like, look, Gary, just do me a favor. Christ. Don't fucking touch anyone's butt. And he goes like, you're asking me not to reach out and touch something as beautiful as a perfect butt. I was like, yeah, I'm telling you, don't do it. He's like, why? Why would I not do it? I mean, that's like, why would you say that? It's like, because
it belongs to someone else. Yeah,
it's against corporate policy, but more importantly, it's wrong. And he's like, there's nothing wrong. You know what? You know what's wrong? You're not believing that God's way is the right way. That's what's wrong. That's why it's wrong. He would refer to Sam Cedar as, where's the Jew? Where's the Jew?
Oh, like, my God.
He's crazy. It's nuts. And so he'd always default to the Christian God thing. So apparently the Christian God had no problems with, you know, him cupping some young girl's rear end. So it was all that kind of stuff. And I'm just telling you, like, literally a fifth, you know, not even a fifth, like 0.05%. I mean, there's every episode was just so fraught with this pain of having to deal with this guy.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I'll tell you, in the edit room, you just say, oh, thank God for him. Thank God for him.
Yeah.
He knew where the cameras were at all times. This is the part where I just like, is he crazy or crazy like a fox? I mean, he knew where the camera was every single time. He knew when to give it a look. He just knew. It was like instinctual. It's bizarre.
Yeah.
And like I said, coming out of the Best Buy saying, was that crazy enough? Was that good? And it's just like, yeah, what, wait a minute. Are you, so you're not crazy? Like it's, and you know, but then having an argument about Bigfoot stealing his girlfriend's camera. It's like, and getting really angry about it when I, you know, implied that Bigfoot, and I don't think it was that I was making fun of it. I don't think he understood that. I think he thought that I was somehow shaming Bigfoot.
He's somehow indicting him. Yeah. You know, in this country, you're innocent until proven guilty and you're unfairly indicting
also,
Bigfoot.
Yeah. And also, Bigfoot is as close to pure nature as possible. What are you fucking talking about?
See, now, when we first met, Jim, I remember that first meet. You flew out to Pennsylvania. I had my little animation studio in some industrial park somewhere. And I remember begging you to ignore what the network might have said about me. Because at that point, we had tried to do the first season of my animated sketch show. And it just fell apart. It was just a disaster. It was a fiasco. Then they brought you in. And they flew you out to meet with me. And I didn't even know that you were on your way out. So I was clueless. I was, in fact, going to take that day off. I was going to do like a Bruce McCullough. I said, I'm going to go on vacation. And so you show up, and I like was begging you. I was like, you know, I'm not a difficult guy. And I'll never forget your response. You were like, you turn to me and goes, Bob, you're easy. I was like, well, yes, now that I've got the perspective of who you had just been working with, Gary Busey, of course I'm going to be a piece of cake. Oh man, that was fascinating. And then, you know, when you talk about first meetings with people, I remember we had lunch on that first day, and I was completely thrown, not only because I was unaware that you were on your way out, but at the same time, I knew your resume. I knew what you had worked on. And of course I had loved Kids in the Hall and Howard Stern and Tom Green and all these things. So you're like this legendary guy coming out, and we're having lunch, and I'm nervous as hell. And I remember I was trying to put some sugar into some iced tea, and I flicked the sugar packets, and I flicked like four sugar packets directly into your dinner. And so I was like, oh, well, this is we're now off to a great start. Now I'm throwing projectiles at Jim Biederman's food. Great. This will turn out well on this already fiasco production. But you know what? Ultimately, Jim, you saved that show. You saved my show.
Oh, thank you.
And I don't think I've ever thanked you for that. So I want to thank you here and now. Because
you're very, very well.
No one else could have done that job. I'm convinced of it. You were the right guy for the right. Not only that, but not only because of what you brought to the table, but also the writers that you brought to the show.
Yeah.
Whether it's John Plummer, Jason Nash, all of these guys who, you
Chris
know.
Chris Brown.
Yeah, Chris Brown. Chris Brown especially. I mean, his background working on G.I. Joe and all those animated shows. And then Jason Nash, who is now just a massive internet celebrity. I mean, first a Yelp, or Vine celebrity, and now he's a YouTube guy. And just blew up, and that was like, for me, that was like a dream team. That first Riding Staff. Yeah,
it was a lot of fun.
Great time. So what are you working on right now, Jim? Other than the History Fluffer podcast,
I'm pitching a thing called American Town Hall, which is currently a live LA show where people come and do essentially a town hall. But they bring their crazy characters into the town hall to complain about, you know, shit people complain about at town halls, you know. And so it's got, like, in the live show, it's like Thomas Middleditch and people like that kind of come in and do guest spots. Mm-hmm. But we're going to try and pitch it as a sketch, like a narrative sketch show. So we'll create a town and these kind of like Little Britain, but with an American town hall kind of as the spine of it. So I'm working on that. And a plumber and I have a thing in Audible, which is exciting.
Oh, great. That's exciting.
An Audible original.
Perfect. Yeah.
And so, a scripted thing. And then, just things like that. I mean, I kind of, at a certain point, kind of like, I have to do the money gig, but I still always try and plan the, you know, well, cause I get a lot of phone calls. Like, well, we have the show and blah, blah, blah. And you're like, oh, that sounds horrible. You know? And you just politely just, you know, I can't. I'm so sorry. I'm busy on the next 5 years. And so it's. But unfortunately, you have to do those every once in a while. But I also, at the same time, I always try and, if I hear about an interesting project, I'll go after it. Yeah, so you know, I'm currently looking for stuff. But I do have to. Unfortunately, I have to jump off.
Sounds great.
I've got to jump off on this conference call. But I would love to do this again if you want me to.
Are you kidding? Yeah, I'd love to talk politics one of these shows too. So definitely, I'll look you up. And you know what? Thank you too for introducing me to Jen Kirkman. She is a genius, and I'm so glad to know her now. She is a master at stand up and everything else. So, thank you, Jim. It's been such a pleasure, and I can't wait to talk to you again real soon.
All right,
take care, man. Bye bye.
Hey, this is Lee Papa, host of AGD Podcast with the Rude Pundit. If you enjoyed this episode, you'll love my show, where every week I talk about politics and interview funny, fascinating, and filthy people. Find it at sexyliberal.com and on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and everywhere else you get your podcasts.